And it is 9 a.m. in the West Coast. It is 12 noon in the East Coast. It is 7 p.m. in Jerusalem, the capital of Israel. Today is October 3rd, 2016, and this is Orly Benny Davis with The Impossible Truth. Today on BBS Radio Studio One, we are going to usher the new Jewish year, and we're going to send our blessing and prayer to all of you. And hoping that it will bring such a start to all the mess that this world is encountering. It's going to be dedicated in the memory of my beloved father that died 2 years to the date. And he was an incredible guy. His name was Clemente Amos Jouili, may bless his soul. It wasn't easy to be by his side when he passed away, but I hope that his teaching and his blessing will keep us going through this incredible new year that we all approaching. Now, the start of this new year, I wanted to just remind everybody that at the end of the Jewish year, we say farewell to one of the icons of the Jewish state, Mr. the President, former President Shimon Peres. A status of such a man, it's hard to recounter. It's amazing how he grew up to be from the fighter to the dove. And sometimes I guess that you have to go through the stages of fighting a war and then understanding that you want peace. But it's sad that when he was 93 years old, he didn't accomplish what he wanted to do in the Middle East, to have peace and to preach to everybody brotherhood of man, that everybody can remember that he was standing for so many years, and he won the Nobel Prize for it with former, God bless his soul too, Rabin, that died, 94, 95, after he was shot. And of course, Yasser Arafat, there were three of them that now they are gone, that started a peace process between the Jewish state and the Arab neighborhood. Now, it's not easy to start without thinking together what's the Jewish New Year means. And I gather some information. Let's listen to what we got about the Rosh Hashanah, the New Year.
The Kabbalists teach that holidays, what we call holidays, aren't simply commemorations of historical events. They're not simply times to get together with the family, but they are opportunities. Opportunities that the Creator gave for all of us to connect to very powerful and specific light, to very powerful and specific energy. And every holiday, true holidays, have a specific energy, a specific type of light that is revealed in them. A specific type of gift or blessing that we can draw into our lives in those times. The Kabbalists teach that what is revealed on Rosh Hashanah is what is called the surrounding light. Because there are different ways we connect throughout the year. There is the Shabbat, there are meditations that we do, there are prayers that we do. But Rosh Hashanah, again, is different than any other connection. Because what we need to accomplish on Rosh Hashanah is the entire year. All 365 days are going to hopefully receive from the flow of abundance that we connect to and we reveal and we draw on Rosh Hashanah. The Kabbalists teach that it's important for us to not only do the actions or celebrate the holidays, more important than actually doing the physical actions is the consciousness, the awareness. Because if we don't know what the purpose of the holiday is, then we cannot truly completely connect to the light that is available at that time. So the Kabbalists stress very, very seriously that it is important for every single one of us to have a deeper and deeper understanding of what opportunities are available, what these holidays are about, what gifts and blessings are available for all of us at these times. It's also important that we know that holidays aren't for one group of people. The holidays that the Creator gave, that are written in the Old Testament, in the Bible, are opportunities for all of us, for all mankind, to use these times, to use these cosmic openings of the flow of the light from the Creator, so that we can improve our lives, bring more fulfillment and blessings into our lives, and bring more light, bring more fulfillment into this world. On Rosh Hashanah, the simplest understanding we must have is that we are given the gift to connect to the energy store. The way we set up the year, the way our year is going to be, the light that we will have in this year, the health that we will have in this year, the prosperity that we will have in this year, the joy that we will have in this year is dependent on how deep our connection is to the energy store on this day. The Talmud speaks of Rosh Hashanah, that a person needs to come to Rosh Hashanah as a poor man, having nothing. What does that mean? That every single one of us on Rosh Hashanah needs to say, I need everything. I have nothing. I need more light. I need more fulfillment. I need more health. I need more joy. I need more love. I need everything more in my life. Because Rosh Hashanah is such an opportunity, but consciousness, to the degree that we limit our certainty, we limit our consciousness on Rosh Hashanah, to that degree, we limit our year. And therefore, it's dangerous on Rosh Hashanah to have limited consciousness. One of the most important lessons that the Zohar teaches is that the light of the Creator is revealed to every single one of us, exactly to the degree that we believe, that we know, that we are certain that it will be revealed. Our consciousness exactly limits or sets aside how much light we will receive, how much light will be revealed in our life. So therefore, understanding and consciousness are the most important tools that we use in preparing, in being ready to receive and reveal this amazing light. So we talk now about Rosh Hashanah. As the Kabbalist teaches, it's one of the greatest opportunities for the whole year for revelation of light. There might not be a more important day in setting up the year, in preparing the year, in bringing the flow of light and blessings into the year than Rosh Hashanah. Because one of the gifts of Rosh Hashanah, and it's really intrinsic to revealing the entire light of Rosh Hashanah, is that we need to remove all of that negative energy that we've created this year. And the gift of Rosh Hashanah is that we can remove all of that darkness, all of the negative energy that we created. Again, the Kabbalists teach that every action that we do of a negative nature creates energy. It's not simply that there's a judge up in heaven who says, you've done bad, I'm going to punish you. But when a person does a negative action, that negative energy stays with him and creates darkness, creates depression, creates sadness, creates problems. One of the gifts of Rosh Hashanah is that we can completely remove all of the negative energy that we have with us, both from this past year, from previous years, and even from previous incarnations. Simply every action that we do creates energy. Positive action creates positive energy. Negative actions create negative energy. And at the end of the year, there needs to be a balance. Either there is more positive energy than negative energy, or more negative energy than positive energy. And the accounting for this, for our actions, the judgment is really what we do to ourselves. But the accounting for this occurs on Rosh Hashanah. If every single one of us, and those that are ready, that their balance of positive energy overweighs the balance of negative energy, then they are ready to receive into them this brand new awakening of the flow of light from Bina. The gift of the Shofar on Rosh Hashanah is that we can awaken through this voice coming out of the Shofar, the sound coming out of the Shofar, to pierce all the barriers, to pierce and break away all of the barriers around our heart, around our soul, around our life, and around this world. This is, the Rav always used the example, you know, can you imagine if one day of the year, the banks open up the vaults and say, anybody who wants can come in and grab whatever they grab. There wouldn't be one person left anywhere. Anybody would run to the bank and grab as much as they could and stick it into their pockets. This is how we need to look at Rosh Hashanah. The gates are open. The overflow of blessings is available on this day. Whatever you grab on Rosh Hashanah, is what you'll have for that year. Whatever you connect to on Rosh Hashanah is what you'll have on that year.
All right, and we are back. It's Orly Benny Davis with The Impossible Truth. That was some Kabbalistic ideas of what's the beginning of a new year's means as far as the Jewish perspective. But just remember, the rules of thumb is whatever goes around comes around. So you better start thinking about good stuff, so good stuff will come your way. And whatever you chip in into this world, you will end up getting it back. It's not easy to indulge yourself with doing good only. And I'm saying indulging because whatever you do and sacrifice today, you will find out in the end of days or after in the day to come when you need some assistance. Being from the Jewish tradition, I tell you that charity is something that is a part of ours tradition and is so important. And especially those days that, they're scarce. Your life is like more challenged than everything else. The days are so hard. You if you take the time to do charity, and it's not, instead of you, it's despite of what you need. It's like to show God, yes, we are here and we're doing it no matter what. And that's where actually the test is ours and we can win it. It's not easy to live in this universe of ours these days when you see everything around is so beautiful. And the same token, you see all those people trying to destroy it. And they're vividly, they are so strongly opposed each other, like they own this world. I don't understand on what ground people stand when they decide to fight some people, especially when they decide to fight them elsewhere, in other people's country. Today we are watching Hurricane Matthew getting stronger and stronger, and Haiti, that is a poor and devastated little island, standing in between. You got Cuba and you got all the East Coast that is in danger. This is the time to ask God for mercy for everybody and ask for pardon, forgiveness, and hopefully that the people are safe there and, nothing will happen to them. And I know that we had a threat not long ago, and we pray hard, and we got God grace. So there is no reason for us to not try to do our best to pray together. So Matthew, this hurricane that can devastate thousands of people's life, will go away as he comes. May it go. And I really hope I'm hopeful for that, because it's not easy. Whatever Haiti had to go through, it's not easy. And I know that there are family and people there. Some people that you run into life and they upset you and everything, but you just want to wish them all the best in the world. And may God protect them and actually send these winds away. All right. I know it's emotional because you see it's coming and you don't know, we just can pray right now. Now we have some program to lead while we're doing it. And I know that Donald Trump was just talking to the veterans, and we have some polls that saying that Hillary Clinton is leading. And whatever it is, we are with the United States of America. It doesn't matter who is the president, but we want it to be fair and cordial, and we want America safe. That's the only thing we want. And, and whatever God, bless us with, will hopefully override all the negative things that happened in the last few years. All right. Let's listen to what Giuliani had to talk about Trump.
So, Mr. Mayor, I've got to start with this bombshell report in the New York Times that Donald Trump may have avoided federal income taxes for almost a generation. Is your campaign disputing the authenticity of these documents from Donald Trump's 1995 tax returns that was mailed by an anonymous source?
Well, all I have is the New York Times story to go by, so let me comment on it as if it's true. First of all, what you failed to leave out of what you said, and it's not your fault, it's the New York Times' fault, is that this is perfectly legal. And the Times makes that point about 26 paragraphs into the opinion. Number two, the Times fails to point out that he has an obligation as the head of a business to take advantage of and to use the lawful deductions and tax advantages that are available to you. I advise my clients to do that, because if they don't do it, they get sued by their co-investors, by their investors. They lose jobs for their employees. Mm-hmm. And the reality is, this is rather common in large, gigantic American businesses, loss carryforwards.
You might remember
a few years ago, it was pointed out that GE paid no taxes.
Yeah.
So the reality is, this is part of our tax code. The man's a genius. He knows how to operate the tax code for the benefit of the people he's serving.
Well, that's interesting, because, Mr. Mayor, you say that he's a genius. Donald Trump said during the debate that not paying federal income taxes makes him smart. Does that mean that the rest of us who don't look for every possible loophole and provision to avoid paying our fair share of taxes, does that mean the rest of us are stupid?
No, absolutely not. In fact, 44%, 45% of America doesn't pay income tax.
Well, a lot of them are below the poverty line. They're not billionaires. They're below the poverty line, and they don't make enough to be taxed.
But someone told them that they don't have to pay taxes. And anybody that goes and has an accountant, H&R Block, or just goes online, figures out all the deductions available to them. I mean, the reality is that most Americans take advantage of every deduction available to them.
Most Americans pay federal income taxes, though, sir, and Donald Trump apparently did not.
Just a little bit over most Americans pay federal income taxes.
Yeah, a majority of the American people pay federal income taxes.
And very large businesses very often take advantage of these kinds of losses.
Do you pay federal income taxes? Jake, you're a successful businessman. Do you pay federal income taxes?
Well, that's between me and my accountant and the IRS. And the reality is, I pay my lawful tax, and he paid his lawful tax.
Well, let me ask you another question, sir.
Jake, wait a second. This is really very unfair. If he didn't take advantage of those tax deductions or tax advantages that he had, he could be sued, because his obligation as a businessman is to make money for his enterprise and to save money for his enterprise. It would have been insane
for him
not to take advantage of it.
Who would sue him for his own personal income taxes?
Investors in his business, people who loan money to his business, banks that loan money to his business. If I have a $200 million loss carry forward that I can use and I don't use it, and I end up costing my company $200 million more, don't you think the bank that I borrowed money from is going to sue me for mismanaging my business?
Well, Mr. Mayor, let me ask you another question.
That's why the simplistic analysis of an extraordinary complex code is so unfair.
I think there are a lot of very, very successful businessmen and women who pay federal income taxes and don't look for every single opportunity there is to avoid paying them. But let me ask you another question. Donald Trump has been selling himself as a brilliant businessman. He's been selling himself as a brilliant businessman.
Wait a second.
He lost almost $1 billion in 1995.
Well, there are not very many smart businessmen who don't take advantage of the tax, legal tax laws that are there. And if they are, then they're not very good businessmen, and no one wants to go into business with them, and they don't have very good lawyers, and they don't have very good accountants.
Okay, but let me ask you, sir, he's selling himself as a brilliant businessman. He lost almost $1 billion in 1995.
Correct.
That doesn't sound particularly brilliant to me.
Well, yes, it does, since he came back, and he came all the way back. And isn't that the history of America? I mean, people like Steve Jobs was fired by Apple and came all the way back. Churchill was thrown out of office twice and came all the way back. It shows what a genius he is. It shows he was able to preserve his enterprise, and then he was able to build it. And the idea that he could carry it forward for 18 years means that at no time in 18 years did he make $916 million. And of course, we know last year he made $685 million. We know that from his financial disclosure.
He hasn't released his tax returns. The only reason we know anything about this is because somebody released this to the New York, somebody leaked this to the New York Times.
We know that he made $680 million last year from his 104-page financial disclosure form.
Mr. Mayor.
Which describes considerably more about his finances than the tax return.
He's the first major party nominee since 1976 to not release his tax returns. If you're proud of that, that's great, but I don't think you should be.
And I am saying the way all of you are treating this is a very good indication of why someone might not want to release their tax returns, because you take something that's perfectly legal, something he had no choice but to utilize, and if he didn't utilize it, he'd have been in a lot of trouble, and you try to make it into... He did no wrongdoing. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton has violated probably 30 federal statutes. He did nothing wrong. The headline should have been, Donald Trump takes advantage of legal provisions in tax code.
That's an interesting headline. I think most Americans are probably interested. Most Americans pay their federal income taxes.
I don't know. You don't know most Americans, and I don't know most Americans.
I know that Americans pay their federal income taxes, sir. Let me ask you something.
I also know that most Americans take advantage of every deduction and every legal opportunity there is to save some taxes, so they don't have to pay as much as they're paying to the government.
In 2012,
most Americans would rather be paying lower taxes under Donald Trump than 10% or 20% more under Hillary Clinton.
In 2012, Donald Trump tweeted, "Half of Americans don't pay income tax despite crippling government debt." He is in that half that does not pay federal income taxes despite crippling government debt. When he rails against the junky infrastructure, when he rails against LaGuardia Airport, when he talks about how bridges are collapsing, is he not responsible, at least in part, for the fact that these things are not being repaired? He's not at all.
Absolutely not.
No.
The law is responsible for it. If you have a set of laws, you live by those laws. And the reality is you are ignoring completely the fiduciary obligation that he has to all the people around him to run his business at the lowest possible expense. Every businessman takes advantage of it, including Warren Buffett. And Warren Buffett thinks we should be paying 90% in taxes. So why doesn't he voluntarily send in that extra 40%? Let him voluntarily make out a check and send it in. If that's what he does, exactly the same thing. He takes advantage of the law.
All right, you guys, it's Orly Benny Davis with The Impossible Truth. Today is the new year, Jewish year, and I hope that you have a fantastic day out there in California and in the East Coast. I hope you celebrate it great. Whoever is around the world, I'm sending all my best. Now, we were talking about and listening to some comments in reply to the debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, where she, as astute a lawyer, attack him that he doesn't pay taxes. But however, an astute lawyer should know the law, because as a builder, there is a loophole. And coming from a family that built a lot of houses in the past, I know that it's a really tricky business. And sometimes, the one that works in one end cannot profit in the same way on the others. But there is a loophole in the law. And the law says and state that for commercial real estate developer, you can claim loss at the end of the year and roll your profit to the next, I guess. What happens is when you build a huge, huge hotels and it's a commercial site, you bring the money forward and you spend, and usually every construction site has a loss, because if anybody from the audience listening is from the construction business, you know that when you give an estimate, it's only an estimate, and it's a wild guess, because at the end of the day, the cost is much higher, the bigger, you know, and the changes on the ground when they happen, they cost money. So there is no question about it that a project can be at the loss. Now, when you have a member of a committee, when your company is owned by, you know, a group of people, you're obligated to run it to the best. And I'm not repeating Giuliani's comment in the same way, because he's not coming from the construction industry, so I guess that he doesn't understand really, or maybe he does, but he didn't go into specific. The idea is, when you build a house, a commercial, a real estate, and you go over budget, you actually have a loss. When you have a loss, you're not supposed to pay any taxes on this. That's how you roll from one project to another. You gain trust by getting more investment, because those investors are the one that put the money, and you just roll with it and build it. This is as far as I'm understanding. So it's not that he did not pay taxes. He built much bigger commercial site than they were predicting, and that's what happens. You know, debates are tricky. They're tricky because they put in motion some elements of doubt in the people's mind, which sometimes are only fiction, because the truth of the matter is we have obligation to cover all security elements in the government, and whoever does not obey by that rule is actually going against the rules. So we have one side that blamed the other on doing something that within the law, as far as the loophole in the tax code, and the other one that actually revealed that was using not classified email system is actually safe from an investigation. So I think that here it's not really perfect, let's say. And I'll let you guys judge. I have no saying in that, because I respect both, and everybody can make mistakes. And of course, I think personally that Hillary wasn't supposed even to take care of this. It's not her responsibility. It was her apparatus that was supposed to cover, to make sure that everything that she touches is security coded. Nobody is perfect, and we need to admit it. We really need to admit it, that, you know, life is not easy for none. We cannot ask for perfection. When you see candidate like this going to run for election, you know that we are questioning ourselves what we really need. And it doesn't matter. We need ourselves to come to the plate. We need ourselves to decide what we're going to do. And we need to ask the big guys to stop fighting. As long as they keep on fighting, we are never going to see the end of the uproar in Syria. Because if Russia and America are going to stand up again and again, doing a match over Syria while children are getting killed, it's not respectful, and God will come to ask us for explanation. So we are calling upon today, upon all the leaders of the free world, with the grace of God, with the help of humanity, to come and together and come to their senses and stop the fighting in Syria and bring some relief to those poor people. And I wanted to let you listen to Mr. Lavrov, whatever he had to say on BBC radio, TV, I guess.
Today is exactly 1 year since President Putin, at the request of President Assad, agreed to send our Air Force to help fight terrorists in Syria. And from the very beginning, we proposed to the American-led coalition to start coordination of these operations and to distinguish, to separate actually the opposition which was cooperating with the coalition led by the United States from Nusra, ISIL and other terrorist groups. The Americans only were ready for deconfliction, as you know, and it took them, I think, several months, a couple of months at least, until in December, we created International Syria Support Group, where they pledged solemnly to take as a priority an obligation to separate the opposition from Nusra. They still, in spite of many repeated promises and commitments, they still are not able or not willing to do this. And we have more and more reasons to believe that from the very beginning, the plan was to spare Nusra and to keep it, you know, just in case for plan B or for stage two, when it would be time to change the regime. I can only recall, speaking of Aleppo, that in August this year, the opposition, where more than 50% were Nusra, as confirmed by the United Nations, has taken the southern western suburb of Aleppo, cutting off 1.5 million people and basically organizing siege, preventing them from getting any supplies by the most easy and available route. And there was no noise, no hysterical statements. The Western people, as far as I understand, who run the show, they thought that this would be the prelude to Aleppo being taken by the opposition. Now the situation is different, and we hear all these noises.
People get killed. If I may, I understand what you are saying, Foreign Minister, but I need to ask you about the situation on the ground. We have seen it on video, the evidence of civilians being killed in their own basements, their bunkers, by your Russian-made bunker-busting bombs. The doctors have told us of the scale of the casualties. Why is Russia continuing with this bombardment when you know what you are doing to the civilian population?
Well, I am coming to it, actually. Getting to it, we take all necessary precautions not to hit civilians. The term collateral damage was invented not by us, you know by whom. And we are taking, as I said, most strict precautions to make sure that we don't hit civilians by any chance. If this happens, well, we are very sorry, but we need to investigate each and every accusation. So far, we have not been given any meaningful proof of what is being said about the convoy which was bombed or attacked on the 19th of September and which we have good reasons to believe was a provocation.
Well,
and we would be the last one.
We can talk about the convoy in a minute, but if you want evidence of what your forces are doing on the ground in Aleppo, then I can provide some. We have seen one of your unexploded Betab bunker-busting bombs actually filmed on the ground in Aleppo, so we know you are deploying those weapons. We also have seen clear evidence of incendiary phosphorus munitions being used, which again come from Russia, cluster bombs as well. These are Russian munitions which violate the international laws of warfare.
Well, we're not using any munition which is prohibited by the United Nations, I can assure you. So about the situation in Aleppo, the entire problem derives from the fact that the United States and the coalition led by the United States cannot and refuses basically to separate the opposition from Nusra and the terrorist groups who joined Nusra. Instead of separation, we see more and more groups coming into alliance with Nusra. And whenever we hit Nusra, we are told, look, you shouldn't do this because there are good people next to it or in the middle of Nusra's position. Then this is a vicious circle. We cannot fight terrorists unless we all agree that those who want to be part of the solution, part of the cessation of hostilities, get out from the positions occupied by them. This is as simple as that. But from the beginning of the U.S. operation in Syria, they started by very reluctantly hitting ISIL, and they only went after ISIL in real way after we started our operation. As for Nusra, they never touched Nusra anywhere in Syria. I raise this problem with John Kerry every time we talk, and we talk basically every day. And today would be another one, as far as I understand, a request from Washington. And he keeps promising that as soon as we stop flying, as soon as Assad stops flying, they would start separating or start thinking about separation. By the way, we had many pauses, many humanitarian pauses during this year, 48 hours, 72 hours at the request of the United Nations. Every time these pauses have been used by Nusra to get from abroad more fighters, more munition, and more weapons. So there must be some first step. There must be some first step, and we have to get our priorities right. Humanitarian things are very important, and we are doing everything now, together with the Syrian government, we made sure they agreed to it, to help the United Nations to get weekly pauses in Aleppo to deliver humanitarian goods. It's the Nusra-controlled people in eastern Aleppo who refuse to do this until there is total quiet, because they run short of the munition and weapons and they need resupply. That's as simple as it is.
Yeah, Minister Lavrov, you talk about your contacts with the Americans. You will know better than me that over the last 12 or so hours, the message from Washington has been simple. Unless you stop the bombing in Aleppo now, then the Americans say they will end all diplomatic contact with you, they'll end all talk of military coordination, and they will look, quote, at all other options. So are you prepared to end the bombing or not?
Well, they also said that Russia would be losing airplanes, soldiers, and Russian cities would be attacked. It was unacceptable threat, and maybe this was, a signal that those who want to do this can start. It's absolutely unacceptable and deplorable, I would say. As for cooperation, there was never cooperation between the two military of Russia and the United States, except for deconfliction. What we did have was discussions and negotiations on documents, which we started issuing sometime in March, but which the Americans did not want to make public. And every time they said, well, we'll make this public after we negotiate another part of it. Then another part, then John Kerry came to Moscow in July, and we finalized a very good document. By the way, the document started with pledge to separate the opposition, the healthy opposition, so to say, moderates, from Nusra. And it was never done. And they were always shy to make these documents public. Eventually, when we finalized the package of five documents on the 9th of September, we decided that this was the time, to start implementing them. And the D-Day was announced on 12th of September. The cessation of hostilities held for a couple of days. The Syrian government did start pulling back its forces from the Castello Road, and the opposition was supposed to do the same. They never did. Instead, they started firing at the Syrian forces pulling back from Castello Road. The Syrian government, as provided by the Russian-American agreements, established its checkpoint on the Castello Road. The opposition was supposed to establish its own. They never did. And now the Castello Road cannot be used. Now Castello Road cannot be used because the opposition threatens to fire at any humanitarian convoy using Castello Road.
Right, let me stop you there.
This is the fact.
Let me stop you there. You've raised something very interesting.
You did stop me there already.
Yes, I did, and thank you for listening to these questions. You say that the Americans struck at that Syrian military post, and you are right. The evidence is clear, and the Americans have said it was a mistake, and they've apologized for the loss of life in that particular incident. They accuse you, as do many international observers and indeed UN officials, of being responsible for the airstrike on an aid convoy. Now, you have never admitted you did it, despite the clear evidence that it did involve the Russian military. So now is your opportunity to apologize for that.
Well, if, as you say, there is clear evidence that this was the job of the Russian military, I would like to see this evidence. I know that the United Nations, in particular on our insistence, announced that they start investigation, and we would be very thoroughly watching how this investigation goes. I can tell you only one thing, and this is the fact known by the United Nations. When the convoy was agreed, the opposition in control of Eastern Aleppo told the United Nations that the convoy should not be launched because they said they had information the government would attack it. The United Nations, in spite of this serious warning, said it doesn't matter whether anybody plans to attack us or not, we are sending the convoy. And to understand what is what might have happened, we have to go back to August 26, when there was another meeting between John Kerry and myself in Geneva. And on that very day, Staffan de Mistura said that humanitarian convoy was ready to leave from Turkey to Eastern Aleppo via Castello Road. And he said, why don't we announce it? It would be so symbolic at the moment when Russia and the United States meet. On that very day, before the convoy left, the Aleppo opposition said that they would hit this convoy, that they would not allow this to get into Aleppo via Castello Road. Then the United Nations basically blinked. They said, okay, maybe we'll talk to them, maybe we'll try to persuade them to change their mind. Let's wait for a couple of days. We waited for a couple of days, and we waited for 2 weeks. Then it was mid-September. The opposition in control of Eastern Aleppo never allowed this convoy in. So now, when the 19th September convoy was about to be launched, the same opposition said that they had information that the government might attack it. Don't you think that this looks fishy?
Well, I'll tell you what looks fishy. The fact and that your aerial surveillance drones were monitoring that convoy and you had two Russian Su-24 warplanes in the air above it. But let us not spend too long discussing that incident. As you say, an investigation is ongoing. Let us look at the bigger picture. We've talked in this interview about your relationship with John Kerry and the Americans. Samantha Power, the U.S. ambassador at the UN, recently said what Russia is doing is not counter-terrorism, it is barbarism. How toxic would you say relations between Washington and Moscow are today?
Well, I think she is a bit aggressive, even for the representative of the United States. We believe it is absolutely unacceptable to use this language. We said what we think about this already. I don't want to come back to this, and I don't want to discuss the manners of our American colleagues. I believe everyone who is aware of how they work know about those manners. And I prefer to concentrate on the facts, not on some hysterical statements when people lose control of events and of themselves.
Do you think the Americans have lost control of both themselves and events?
Well, I think that if they do not present any evidence to the contrary, they either are driven by Nusra or they tacitly support this terrorist organization. And I believe, you know, if you take the history, during Reagan administration, Al-Qaeda was born because the United States was supporting Mujahideen movement in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union. During George Bush Jr., ISIL was born after they invaded Iraq and after, in May 2003, they dismantled any structure with Sunni population, be it army, be it security, be it police. And I am afraid that this particular administration of the United States might make history by being the administration which gave rise and support to Nusra.
Let me ask you a few quick-fire questions, and if you would, Foreign Minister, quick-fire answers as well. Is all talk of of a cessation of hostilities, a meaningful ceasefire in Syria, over? Is that prospect at an end?
No, it is not over. And when we met in New York, we said that we are ready to implement the document which we agreed in full, provided this time we don't get any pretext to delay the separation. Let's sit down, let's have the map, and let the American and Russian officers to exchange information and to clearly indicate on that map where Nusra is. Then everything can start. because we don't want to be cheated again and again.
All right. A bigger strategic thought now. In March of this year, President Putin announced that there was going to be a pullback of Russian forces from Syria, which would begin in the spring. Here we are at the end of September, 1 year into your military operations, and far from a pullback, you are being drawn ever more deeply into the Syria conflict. Your strategy hasn't worked, has it?
No. I believe that you are making it a bit wrong, because what he did say, that we would be partially withdrawing our air force from there, and he made a caveat that if the situation requires, we would always be able to build back the force in Syria.
The bottom line is, it looks to many people, and this is what the Americans are saying.
All right, we are back with Orly Benny Davis with an impossible truth. It's New Year's Day in the Jewish state in Israel, and we were listening to Foreign Secretary Lavrov talking about the standing of Russian in the opposition to the U.S. Position in Syria. Now, the deal is like this. Syria does belong to the Syrian people. Russian was invited to protect them before, but I guess that she pulled back, so she doesn't have authoritarian, I guess, legal, if I may assume that she didn't get requested again to protect Assad regime. I think that we need to pull back from all, and not to get involved with China now, putting our nose into the mix, and let some group of international forces. Guys, Russia and America do not have the up. They are not holding the idea that we need to have a peaceful coexistence in the region there. They're fighting for their stance. And I think that because they're so up and above in everything, and they're really the ultimate power in the universe, except God, of course, but like a power from the military standing point, I think that it's not conducive for them to engage more in this little country called Syria. It's too small for there to fight. If they want to go, let's take an empty desert in Africa and do your battle. But leave the Middle East alone, leave Syria alone, and this stand-up who's group, and assuming that the Russian know exactly who are al-Nusra and all the people are involved there and how we gonna attack them, it's really ludicrous for them to even position themselves in such a statement, because nobody know in the region who's who. They don't know in themselves, because one day they're black, one day they're green, one day they're yellow. They don't even have a clue. They wake up, whoever is the leader of the group in that moment. So to go and decide who's going to get killed, and one word you can, Lavrov is very smart. He's really, really smart. And he positioned himself in very well against the ambassador Powell. But he made one mistake using provocation. The USA does not provoke Russia in Syria. It's not their territory. It's nobody's territory. It's the Syrian people territory. So I want those two giants to please excuse us all little countries around here. And we want this mess to get out of our neighborhood. When you have two bullies coming to town and you said, okay, you guys, can you take it elsewhere? So we asking, this is the eve. And we're praying before God that, to help us, because we might have to ask the good guys from Canada, from Great Britain, and Australia, people that actually can weigh in and ask them Can you please take it back to United Nations, create a subcommittee and resolve it there, and then come back and help us set a new day for the region? Because for them to be fighting around here, it's everlasting. It's going to be forever. So I know that I run out of time. I know that it's almost time for me to say goodbye. And I know we didn't play any music, but I guess that we have some concern. So I want to salute you all. And next time we're going to talk about the Brexit. We're going to talk about how it's going to evolve. And I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful week ahead. And you take care of yourself very well. And I hope that God will bless us with a good, good new year. And may you all be scribe in the book of life and wonderful things for everybody around. Okay, so until then, next time. Always come to visit in Jerusalem. And I wanted to thank you all before I leave. Thank you, President Obama, for coming, giving grace for Perez and President Clinton and all the great leaders that came last week to visit Israel and say goodbye to these incredible leaders. May you all be blessed. Thank you so much and talk to you soon. God bless. Ciao, ciao.